Ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Lee, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this opening event of the UCSB Global Warming Science and Society event series. Just 9 months ago, this existed only in the form of a short proposal I had written for consideration by our campus. But now, thanks to the hard work and dedication of many individuals across our campus and in our community, this series is a reality. I especially want to recognize UCSB's superb Arts and Lectures program. They secured the funding and had the bold vision to host a science-based series within their events. I also want to thank our media sponsors, KCLU, Santa Barbara Independent, Cox Media, and Cox Communications. The purpose of the Global Warming Science and Society event series is to bring world-class speakers to our campus and to the Santa Barbara community to inform, educate, and stimulate debate and action on this great challenge of our times. To that end, we have assembled a group of speakers and events that span the three broad areas that define the issue of global warming: the science of climate change, energy and technology, and societal impact. The breadth and nature of this series reflects the interdisciplinary strength of research, scholarship, and teaching on environmental issues on our campus. Tonight's event, as you all know, features Dr. James Hansen. As you will see from your program, after Dr. Hansen's lecture, we will have a panel discussion that will include Dr. Hansen, Dr. Ralph Keeling, and myself. I also want to remind you that there are many associated events and talks to come, as you will see on the PowerPoints flashing behind me. We will also be posting up-to-date information on the website associated with the series. Our next Arts and Lectures event will feature Dr. Steve Coonan, Chief Scientist of British Petroleum, speaking on March 8th about the future of energy. And now to tonight's event. It is an honor for me to introduce Dr. James Hansen, Director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York City. Dr. Hansen has been a pioneer in every sense of the word on the issue of climate change. He changed the way we look at climate with his unique early perspective of global warming as a planetary energy balance problem, and with his work on the application of climate models to future climate prediction. His research defines much of how we think about climate change, from the sensitivity of the climate system and its feedbacks to the rapidity of how climate responds. Under his leadership, NASA GIS has set the standard for compiling surface temperature data from around the world for comparison to climate predictions. Dr. Hansen has also been an outspoken voice for action on climate change for over 20 years. Speaking courageously and with conviction, even when political winds were blowing against him. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. James Hansen to UC Santa Barbara.
Okay. Thanks very much. Well, this couldn't have happened a few years ago. I guess this subject is becoming more popular. The answer to this question is yes. But there's another more interesting question, and that is, will we avoid dangerous climate change? And that, the answer is not so obvious. And the answer is really up to you. And I'm always a little puzzled why young people, and I notice many of you are young people, don't get a little more disturbed about this issue, because you are really the ones who are getting the short end of the stick. I need to start by, since we're talking about global warming, I need to show one curve of global warming. This is the temperature for the last century or so, and it has, the temperature has increased by 0.8 of a degree Celsius, with 75% of that increase coming in the last 30 years. That's about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 1 degree Fahrenheit in the last 30 years. Early in the period, there are a number of different factors affecting the temperature, but now the effect of greenhouse gases has sort of taken over as a dominant effect, and there's a clear positive trend to the temperatures. But 1.5 degrees is, is not very large compared to weather fluctuations from day to day. You know, these are maps of the monthly temperature anomaly for approximately the last year. And the red areas are warmer than normal, where normal was 1951 to 1980. And blue is colder than normal. So you can see red areas tend to predominate. And if you looked at the United States, you'd find that the monthly average temperature, I think I counted there were 6 months that were red, quite warm, and 3 that were blue, and 3 that were kind of normal. But if you look at a longer period of time, like a season, these are the last 12 seasons, then it turns out there were 8 seasons that were red and 2 that were blue and 2 that were normal. And if you look at the last 12 years, then there are 10 of them that were red and 1 blue and 1. So if you average over bigger times, then the weather fluctuations tend to. But you have to look at longer time periods if you want to see the impact of global warming, because it's just not that large yet. So then why are we worried about it? Well, for one thing, there's additional global warming that's in the pipeline. It takes the climate system time to respond to the changes in atmospheric composition. There's another 1 degree Fahrenheit warming in the pipeline due to gases already there. And then there's at least another 1 degree Fahrenheit warming in the pipeline due to the power plants that are already in existence and are not going to be turned off immediately, even if we decide to do something about the problem, and the vehicles on the road, that we're not going to take off the road suddenly. So there's, 3 times the amount of warming that's already occurred if you count what's in the pipeline. And that's why we need to start to deal with the problem now. And then just one more map. This is the temperature anomalies relative to 1951 to 1980 for the first 5 years of this century. And what I want to say is the nature of this warming makes sense. It agrees with what we expect and what we calculate in the global models. For example, the warming is larger over land than it is over ocean because the oceans have thermal inertia, and it takes them longer to respond to the forcing that we're applying. The warming is greater at high latitudes than it is at low latitudes because there are positive feedbacks that amplify the impact of the forcing at high latitudes, especially snow and ice, which tend to melt as it gets warmer, and that makes the surface darker and absorb more sunlight. And the warming is larger in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere because there's more ocean in the southern hemisphere, and especially the southern ocean mixes heat deeply, so it hasn't warmed up much in the southern ocean. And even that little funny warming in the Antarctic Peninsula and the absence of much warming in Antarctica also is expected because it's partly due to the ozone depletion over Antarctica, which ozone is a greenhouse gas just like carbon dioxide, so if you have less of it, you get a cooling effect, and that's partly counterbalanced the CO2 warming. And the changes in those gases also affect the atmospheric dynamics and increase the zonal winds there, and that tends to warm the peninsula but not the continent. But I'm going the wrong direction. Okay. Now, essentially all the countries in the world agreed in 1991, 16 years ago, in this framework convention on climate change, that we should take actions to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions at a level that would prevent dangerous human-made interference with the climate system. So you would think that, since we need to define what is dangerous level, that would be a hot research topic, but it hasn't actually been a lot of papers. In fact, I submitted one in 2005, which I'm still trying to get published. There seems to be a reluctance to quantitatively address this problem. But I have my opinions. And my list of metrics for what would constitute dangerous starts with the things that are irreversible, and one of those is extermination of species, which is some scientists euphemistically call reduction of biological diversity. But that is obviously irreversible, the extinction of species. And ice sheet disintegration and sea level rise, for all practical purposes, is also irreversible on any human time scale. It takes many thousands of years to build the ice sheets. And also there are important regional climate changes, which I'll talk briefly about. One of the problems is that as the planet gets warmer, plants and animals which are adapted to and can survive only in specific climate zones attempt to migrate to stay within their climate zone if the climate changes. But of course, those species that live at the poles don't have any colder place to migrate to, and they are in danger of, an iconic species like the polar bear is not going to literally go into extinction, because of course we will save the polar bear in the zoos, if nothing else. That may not be considered by the bear to be might be more like jail, but region that is we're in danger of pushing species off the planet is the alpine areas, which are particularly biologically diverse, the slopes leading up to the mountains. And as the temperature line, as the planet gets warmer, a given temperature line moves up the mountain. But when that happens, of course, the area gets smaller and it gets rockier and the air gets thinner. And in effect, we can also push off the planet the species in alpine regions. But even in other regions, animals and plants attempt to migrate as the climate changes. I got this email from a man in Arkansas who noted that he had never seen armadillos before, but he drives this 40-mile route, north-south route, and he's noted that they're moving further north. Armadillo has been around 50 million years. And I think he's a pretty tough critter, so I suspect that he will probably survive. Homo sapiens have been around, 150,000 years or something? I guess the predecessor, Homo erectus, maybe 2 million years. But many species will have trouble, partly, I mean, at this time, the stresses on different species, animal species, are probably more due to other things that we're doing by taking over the planetary surface. But most experts agree that as we go into this century, the big stress on species is going to come from the combination of the stresses they already have plus climate change. And one way we can partly quantify this is looking at the rate at which a given temperature line is moving poleward as the planet gets warmer. If we look at the last half of the last century, the poleward migration of isotherms was averaged about 12 kilometers per decade. Well, but in the last three decades, if you remember my first graph, the last 30 years, temperatures really started going up quite rapidly. And the rate of movement of an isotherms has been more like average 38 kilometers per decade. If we follow business as usual scenarios, which energy departments tell us act as if it's a God-given fact that we have to follow business as usual and continue to burn more and more fossil fuels each year. If we do that, the rate of isotherm movements is likely to be of the order of 60 kilometers per decade. And, you know, as long as that total distance that the isotherms have moved is not too large, so it's smaller than the region within which a given species lives, it's not as serious. But as you get accumulated larger and larger movement of the isotherms, it becomes a bigger problem. And I like to contrast the business as usual scenario with what I call alternative scenario, which is designed to keep additional global warming less than 1 degree Celsius. And that's still, as I mentioned, there is still more warming in the pipeline, and even if we begin to take actions, we're going to get some additional warming, but the movement of isotherms is much less in that case. It's hard to say what the impact of global warming on the number of species will be. There have been some attempts to estimate that. One source of guidance is the history of the Earth. There have been several large, rapid warmings in the Earth's history. The most recent one, large one, being 55 million years ago at the Paleocene-Eocene boundary, when the global warming was probably about 6 degrees Celsius or so, and more than 90% of the species on the planet went extinct with that warming. With business as usual, canonical climate sensitivity, we expect global warming of the order of 3 degrees Celsius, and I think that would be disastrous for a huge number of species on the planet. The second irreversible impact of global warming that I like to focus on is sea level and the potential melting of portions of Greenland and Antarctica, specifically West Antarctica, is the portion that is most unstable. The reason we're concerned, we've become very concerned about Greenland, is we note that the area on Greenland that has been experiencing melting in the summer has been increasing. These maps show the area of melt in red in 1992 and 2002, and the 2005 broke the record of 2002 with still larger area of melt. The thing about the surface, this is a photograph on the surface of Greenland, and it shows some of the summer melt. It doesn't run off the edge of the ice sheet into the ocean. It will find a low point, a crevasse, and there it just burrows a hole all the way to the base of the ice sheet. And there it serves to lubricate the base of the ice sheet. And increase the flux of icebergs, of these giant icebergs, to the ocean. This is the largest ice stream on Greenland, and it has doubled in its flux of icebergs to the ocean in the past several years. And the same has happened on all of the major ice streams on Greenland. And it had, well, when that was first reported, the contrarian said, "Oh, but Greenland is actually getting heavier, is getting bigger because of global warming. It snows more, the air holds more water vapor, and you get more snowfall in the central regions of Greenland." And that's true, but it's a question of the balance of these two effects. And we now, beginning in 2002, we have this really spectacular satellite called GRACE, which is a gravity satellite, or a pair of satellites that follow one after the other, and from the relative separation of them, you can measure very precisely the gravity field of the Earth, and you can measure the mass of the Greenland ice sheet. There's actually a improved orbits now for those satellites, and we have smoother curves for this seasonal cycle. During the winter, the mass of Greenland increases, and then during the summer and fall, it decreases. But over this time period, it lost mass at a rate of about 150 cubic kilometers per year. And we also notice, you know, there are these seismometers located all around the world which are used to detect earthquakes at different and to locate and measure the magnitude of earthquakes that occur any place in the world. And they've started to find earthquakes occurring on Greenland. These are, in fact, ice quakes. What happens is a piece of the ice sheet will surge forward down slope toward the ocean, and then it grinds to a halt on the solid Greenland surface, and it's registered as an earthquake with some magnitude someplace between 4.6 and 5.1 on the Richter scale. But the number of these earthquakes on Greenland doubled between 1993 and 1999, and since then it has doubled again because of this increased surface melt, which makes the ice sheet less stable. I should also say we now, that the gravity satellite shows that the West Antarctic ice sheet, even though, as I showed on the earlier map, the warming there is very minimal so far, in part because of the ozone depletion, but we expect it to increase. But the mass of the West Antarctic ice sheet has also been decreasing at a rate of about 150 cubic kilometers per year, which, you know, you add those two up and it comes to less than 1 millimeter. You spread it all around the world, and it's less than 1 millimeter of sea level. But it has caused the rate of sea level rise, which in the last century was about 15 centimeters, at a rate of about 15 centimeters per century. And the last 25 years or so, it went up to 25 centimeters per century. And in the last dozen years that we have very precise measurements from satellites, it's about 35 centimeters per century. So it is increasing. And it's just a very nonlinear problem. The danger is that we could push these to the point where we get a rapid collapse of most likely West Antarctica and also the southern half of Greenland. So it's hard to say. how long it will take to get a large sea level change, but with so-called business as usual global warming, business as usual 2% per year increase in fossil fuel use, we would expect at least 3 degrees Celsius global warming. The last time the world was 3 degrees Celsius warmer was a few million years ago during the Middle Pliocene, and sea level then was 25 plus or minus 10 meters higher than it is now, and that's 80 feet. Now that's that's something that obviously we don't want to be headed in that direction. There's a big disagreement among scientists about how long it takes ice sheets to respond to the changed forcing. And IPCC has come out, this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you probably heard about them in the news recently, and they've come out with estimates for very small increases in sea level this century. Well, they're only have quantified the thermal expansion of the ocean and the melting alpine glaciers. They have simply not dealt with this Greenland-Antarctic problem because it's difficult. But it's by far the greatest threat as far as sea level is concerned. And in my opinion, as a physicist, I cannot imagine how West Antarctica or the southern half of Greenland could survive if we follow business as usual, because we would have both of those ice sheets covered with summer melt and at increasing rates. And and the disintegration of an ice sheet is wet process, unlike the growth of an ice sheet, which can proceed only at the rate of a snowfall. It's limited by the rate of snowfall in a cold place. And we know from the Earth's history, if we look at the last time an ice sheet disintegrated, was the Laurentide ice sheet in central Canada, 14,700 years ago. And sea level then, during Meltwater Pulse 1A, sea level went up 20 meters in 400 years. So that's 1 meter every 20 years. So when an ice sheet disintegrates, it can disintegrate very rapidly. And if we had sea level of that increase, of that magnitude, it would have dramatic consequences on the east coast of the United States. And with a 25-meter sea level rise, the entire country of Bangladesh would be underwater, and 250 million people in China. So, you know, really, it's such a... If you compare that with... I don't remember the population of New Orleans, but that's a village by comparison. This is several orders of magnitude more people involved. So it's really something we can't... don't want to contemplate. And just to say one thing about regional climate change, it used to be that we would only say that, well, the extremes of regional climate will increase as global warming increases, because we couldn't really say with the patterns. But now there's one thing that all the models agree on, and it also makes physical sense. As you have more global warming, you get more evaporation from the ocean, and the tropical rain belt, intensity of rainfall increases. But also the counterpart of that is the subtropical regions, the atmosphere becomes more stable. And that has implications for at least two regions, one of them being the western half of the United States and one being the Mediterranean region, where both of which we expect decreases of precipitation on the long run. And because temperatures will be going up, particularly in these regions with less rainfall, it's going to be hotter and drier in these regions. And I think, you know, we're beginning to see the first small steps in that direction already. And again, also the history of the Earth, if you look at paleoclimate records, there is a strong correlation between global temperature and drought in the western United States. So I think there's a danger of really having super drought in the U.S. West if we follow business as usual and have large global warming. And one thing that implies is more forest fires, and with higher temperatures, it would be very damaging to the forests. I think there is some evidence that forest fires are beginning to increase. Now, let's look at the history of the Earth. This is the temperature in Antarctica as obtained from an ice core. You know, Antarctica is a couple of miles thick ice sheet formed by snowfall piling up year after year, and it was too cold for it to melt. So as it gets thick enough, it compresses the snow at a depth of about 100 meters to ice, and the ice traps bubbles of air. If we drill a core through the ice sheet, we can sample the snow that fell as a function of time for the last 400,000 years. There's even now a core that goes back even longer. And we can sample the composition of the air in those bubbles and determine the composition of the Earth's atmosphere over this time period. And you can see that this is the temperature which varies by about 10 degrees Celsius in Antarctica between the warm interglacial periods and the depths of the ice ages. Now, the time runs from left to right, and we've been in this relatively warm interglacial period, the Holocene, for almost 12,000 years now. That's the period in which civilization developed, and it's been a relatively warm climate. These cycles where it gets colder over 100,000 years and then suddenly gets much warmer and then it repeats, these cycles are related to changes in the Earth's orbit. As you may know, the Earth's orbit is perturbed by Jupiter and Saturn, and because they're so heavy, and Venus because it comes very close, and it causes the tilt of the Earth's spin axis to wobble by plus or minus 1 degree. It's tilted now at about 23.5 degrees, but that wobbles, and also the orbit is not perfectly circular, it's elliptical, and the degree of ellipticity changes with time. And the date in the year at which we're closest to the sun cycles through the entire season in about 23,000 years. But one thing we can do with this is compare the current Holocene interglacial period with the last ice age 20,000 years ago. And by the way, the bubbles of air tell us that the composition of the atmosphere was changing with these same cycles. When the planet was warmer, there's more carbon dioxide and more methane in the atmosphere. If you compare these curves very carefully, you'll find that the temperature tends to change first by several hundred years. It's almost simultaneous. If you try to lay these on top of each other, they would look like they were congruent. But there is a slight lag, so the temperature change, in effect, is causing the Earth to release more CO2 and methane. But on the other hand, the CO2 and methane are a one mechanism for the temperature change. They contribute to the temperature change. It's not the only thing that affects the temperature, and they're doing it as a feedback, but we can compare the current interglacial with the last ice age, And we know, in addition to knowing how the atmosphere changed, we know how the surface conditions changed between the Ice Age and the Interglacial. During the Ice Age, there was an ice sheet that covered Canada and reached down, covered Seattle and Minneapolis and New York City. It was so large that sea level was 110 meters lower. There was so much water locked up in this ice sheet and a smaller ice sheet on Eurasia. but because of that large ice sheet area, the planet reflected more sunlight, so the Earth absorbed less sunlight. A climate. So let me quantify these in terms of climate forcings. A climate forcing is an imposed perturbation of the planet's energy balance. So, for example, if the sun were to become 1% brighter, that would be a forcing of 2.4 watts because the Earth absorbs 240 watts of energy from the sun averaged over the surface of the planet. So 1% would be 2.4 watts. Well, this ice sheets were big enough to reflect away sunlight so that it caused a forcing of 3.5 watts. And the greenhouse gases, since there were less of them during the Ice Age, that was a forcing of about 2.5 watts. So this total forcing of about 6.5 watts maintained a planet that was 5 degrees colder. It's 10 degrees colder at the poles. The global average temperature changes in these swings from ice ages to interglacials tend to be about twice as large at the poles as they are on the global average. They tend to be 3.5 or 4 degrees at the equator, 5 degrees on global average. So that implies a sensitivity of about 0.75 degrees for each watt of forcing. Well, that applied to just that one period of time that we checked, but we can actually now look at other points in time because we have a sea level record. We have more than one record, and they differ somewhat from each other, but they all show that the variations are typically 100 meters between a glacial and interglacial period. And this is a record of sea level change over the last 400,000 years. Since the last ice sheet 20,000 years ago had a forcing of 3.5 watts, this tells us how much water there is locked up in the ice sheets. And we know that when ice sheets grow, they get bigger, they get thicker as well as bigger in both horizontal dimensions, so that the area of the ice sheet would go roughly like the 2/3 power of the amount of water. And so we can calculate the climate forcing as a function of time due to the change in the ice sheet area for this entire 400,000 years. And we can also calculate the climate forcing due to the change in methane and carbon dioxide. And if we just take those forcings, add the two of them together, and multiply by the climate sensitivity of 0.75 degrees for each watt, we get a calculated temperature for the last 400,000 years given by the blue curve at the bottom, which compares remarkably well with observed temperature variations, which tells us not only that climate sensitivity that we estimated seems to be good for the entire period, but we can also draw some other conclusions. The two principal mechanisms for causing the temperature change during that 400,000-year period were the changes in atmospheric composition and the changes of the surface properties. Those were the mechanisms. The instigator, very weak forcing, was the changes in the Earth's orbit. But then these powerful feedbacks, changes in atmospheric composition and the ice sheets on the surface, amplified the effect of the very weak forcing and caused large climate changes. Well, now those mechanisms, which were forced by these small changes in the Earth's orbit, those mechanisms are now totally under the control of humans. If you look at the greenhouse gases, they're now going off the scale that it existed during the past 400,000 years. Those are due to human. I've greatly expanded the time scale on the right side of this diagram. There's just 100, 150 years on this right side, so I had to magnify that so you could see what's happening. But humans are now in control of the atmospheric composition. And ice is melting all over the planet. So both of these mechanisms for temperature change are going in the same direction, and they're under our control. And if we look at, and then one of the questions is, well, how big does the temperature change have to be before it's dangerous? Well, again, I think looking at the Earth's history is our best guide. And this is the temperature at some very important regions on the globe, in the warm pool in the Western Pacific and in the Indian Ocean. These are important because those regions are the source of heat that's transported to higher latitudes, both by the atmosphere and by the oceans. And so they're a good indicator of the status of the planet. And you can see that, again, I've greatly expanded the time scale on the right, but you can see that the warming in the last 130 years has now brought the temperature within 1 degree or less of the most of the warmest periods in the past. This is now a million years. This is from a ice core, an ocean core, from which you can also derive temperature records. Actually, it's David Lee's ocean core, I think. But anyway, there's another ocean core in the Indian Ocean. As again, you can see that this warming in just the last several decades has, again, getting us within a degree or so of the warmest temperature in a very long time. The bottom line is humans now control global climate, for better or worse. And humans have more than an effect on just CO2 and these other greenhouse gases, and ozone, which is also a greenhouse gas. Humans are also affecting aerosols, small particles in the atmosphere. There's black soot, mainly from fossil fuel burning. And then there are sulfates and other aerosols, and those have an effect on clouds. And those both are cooling effects, as opposed to the warming effects of greenhouse gases. Well, if we look at... there are also natural effects, like volcanoes that go off, and those have a cooling effect. If we add up all of the forcings and put those in a global climate model and calculate temperature for the last century, it agrees with the global climate model. It agrees very well with observed temperatures. And we can then use such a model, which agrees with observations over the last century, and extend it into the future. If we stay on business as usual, we will get warming of a few degrees Celsius. And I also want to talk about this alternative scenario, which is designed to keep warming less than 1 degree. But the problem is fossil fuel CO2 emissions is the principal thing. In 1973, with the Arab oil embargo and with some attempts to use fuels more efficiently, especially in the United States, we increased miles per gallon requirements from 13 miles per gallon to about twice that. The growth rate of fossil fuel emissions decreased from almost 5% a year to a little less than 2% a year. Problem is, that's now the business as usual course. And unfortunately, we're going to have to get this to decrease rather than to continue to increase if we're going to avoid business as usual warming. And in practice, what that means, the red areas are the fuel that's already been burned and put in the atmosphere for oil, gas, and coal. Well, it's going to be very difficult, probably impossible, to avoid using the easily available oil and gas. And that is enough to put us up to about 450 parts per million. So we could still avoid, in order to avoid going above 1 degree Celsius additional warming, we cannot use the unconventional fossil fuels. This is tar sands and tar shale, which there are some energy companies starting to plan to cook the Rocky Mountains and drip oil out of them. It is a very energy-intensive process to do that. And then you end up with oil, which then itself ends up as CO2 in the atmosphere. We simply can't do that without producing a completely different planet. But we also cannot afford to burn all of this coal unless we are going to capture the CO2 and sequester it. Now, we could... The problem is that, and this hasn't been, how much time do I have? Almost time, yeah, okay. Okay, so the problem is that about a quarter of the carbon dioxide that we burn stays in the air forever, more than 500 years, which for practical purposes is forever. But if we would phase out coal use between 2025 and 2050, so you linearly phase it out so that you're no longer using it except where you sequester it after 2050, then we could stay within this 450 parts per million. So the bottom line is that I think warming of greater than 1 degree Celsius risks having a different planet. We have this limit that we need to try to aim for CO2. And then this becomes some opinions, but based on the science, I think that it's very critical that we have more energy efficiency so that we can stretch the oil and gas until we have alternative energies. Rather than starting to use these unconventional fossil fuels. And that's going to require both incentives and standards. And by incentives, I mean a price on carbon emissions. And it certainly is going to require that the United States take a leadership role, because we're by far the largest source of accumulated emissions, and we're a technological leader and a political leader. I think that means that, there are very good reasons why we would like to become less dependent on fossil fuels. And I think that it does require having a price on carbon emissions in order to spur technology development and efficiency. And there would be many benefits of doing that, for our energy independence and our national security, and dollars from that price would stay in the U.S. instead of going elsewhere. And I think it actually would be economically beneficial, but it needs to be debated. I also point out that although China is going to pass us in current emissions, but what is important is the accumulated emissions. And we have more than three times the emissions of any other country. And even taking account of the lag time of the climate system, we are much more responsible for the climate change than any other country. So I'm concerned in part about this legacy. We're leaving for our children and our grandchildren a a moral burden, because, you know, as people have to begin to abandon their islands or their coastal locations, it's clear who is mainly responsible. We have not only been more than three times the emitter, but we've also actively discouraged international accords which were designed to address this problem. So we're leaving quite a burden for our youngsters. And, you know, there was a previous problem, an atmospheric problem, the ozone depletion, where when we realized there might be a problem, we stopped building new factories and the production was constant. And when we proved there was a problem, there was an international agreement, the Montreal Protocol, which the Kyoto Protocol was then designed to mimic. But unlike the ozone story, where the scientists gave a clear warning and most of the people, and the United States took a leadership role in seeing that this accord was reached and that the developed world gave the developing world an extra 10 years before they had to match the requirements. But in this case, I don't think that we scientists have done a very good job of making clear the dangers that are involved. And I think that special interests deserve a double demerit, because they've been very effective both through the media and on the government in preventing the actions that are needed from occurring, and they've left the public confused. So although all of these categories, I think, bear some of the responsibility, but unfortunately it's going to be the young people who are going to pay in the future. This is the final thing now. I think that to address the problem, because some additional increase in CO2 is certainly going to occur, we need to address some of these non-CO2 forcings. We could get some of these to decrease. And if we did that, we could, I think, save the Arctic as well as keep global warming under 1 degree Celsius. And there are a lot of other reasons that it would be useful to address these other pollutants as well as CO2. But I think I better stop here. Thanks.
Thanks for your attention. The panel was my idea, so if it flops, you can all you can pelt me. But I thought it would be interesting. One of the things, I've been interested in this issue for a long time, and one of the things I've been struck by is that occasionally this issue emerges on talk shows on TV, and when it happens, it's a disaster. It was on a Larry King show the other night, and I actually just read the transcript, but it's an embarrassment. I mean, there's no serious discussion of the issue, so I watch Meet the Press every Sunday morning after my son watches Sesame Street, and I admire Tim Russert, and so I thought it would be interesting to try to do that, but this is the first time I'm doing it, so I'm going to bumble a bit. What I want to do first is introduce our other guest tonight, Ralph Keeling, from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, part of University of California, San Diego. Ralph is an atmospheric chemist who, I think it's safe to say, has inherited the legacy of monitoring the changes in atmospheric composition that are a result of our use of fossil fuels. His father, Charles David Keeling, was the scientist who first began to monitor the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is, of course, the famous Keeling curve, and you can actually buy a T-shirt with this data on it, and I love that data, it's beautiful. And his son Ralph, unfortunately Dr. Keeling passed away last year, but his son Ralph has been kind enough to join us for the panel. And I asked Ralph to join the panel for a number of reasons. Partly the legacy of being part of this first family of global warming in California, partly that Ralph has taken over this work, but also because Ralph, I think, has a unique perspective, having grown up with this science and seen this problem develop, much as also Dr. Hansen does. So I'm going to start by asking you, Ralph, just to make a few remarks, either just of an informal nature about your own response to the problem and also any response you might have to Jim's talk.
Okay, well, thank you very much, David. It's a great pleasure to be here. I also want to say that it's a great honor to be on the podium with Jim Hansen here, who I am very grateful to see is attracting a crowd of this kind of proportions, because I think it's a very good reflection of the efforts he's put in over these years. And as a scientist, I can say that he's been looked up to among scientists as kind of a beacon of inspiration in lots of ways, not just leading in the science, but also leading as a human being and a personal, as a way of a personal example of how to stand up to various kinds of intimidation and difficulties that he's faced along the way. I know that as a federal employee, he's had a rather hard road to hoe in the last few years and over the last few decades. And I have colleagues who are also in the government, and I can say with some confidence that the example of Jim Hansen has led to courageous behavior on the parts of other people as well. So it's...
That reminds me. I forgot to make my required statement. My comments are my personal opinion, and I am a federal employee, but I'm not today representing the government.
So I wanted to say a little bit about my perspective on the history of this, and I want to roll back the clock a couple decades here. There was a time when there was the topic of global warming had already been around for 20 years or more. My father's measurement started in the late 50s. There was always already an awareness that this was an interesting problem and an important problem by the early 60s. And by the late 70s, there was enough awareness of this that there was a panel commissioned by the National Academy of Sciences to conduct a kind of an external review to see whether this issue really had merit, because you could always imagine that the scientists involved are screwing around creating some kind of fuss just to get research funds or some such. So this was the National Academy of Science report chaired by probably the most distinguished dynamic meteorologist, kind of the father of numerical weather forecasting, a man named Jules Charney. This report came out, and it basically concluded that, yes, you needed to take the science of global warming very seriously. And there was also an interesting statement in this report, and I'll read it to you. It says, "We may not be given a warning until the CO2 loading is such that an appreciable climate change is inevitable." Now, that was 1979. Okay? So what's happened in the meantime is we missed it. Okay, so that's the first thing to realize, is that we, the scientists, were trying then to give a warning. And we were trying to, I don't say we, but and by the way, Jim's model contributed directly to that report, so he was there part of the process. But somehow this didn't take traction. In a way, it doesn't surprise me too much. But the hope that we could have gotten through this and modified our behavior to avoid serious consequences is no longer a realistic hope. What we're talking about is changing the scope of what we face and not dodging the bullet, if you will. Now, but I still see, looking at where we are now, a clear dichotomy, as Jim does, between different courses of action. And I'd like to try to put that in a perspective of kind of the typical human narrative. And it also to clarify that I think some of the difficulty we have as scientists in actually telling this story in the right light. The classic storyline will have some kind of moment of tension or period of tension, of struggle, the suffering and loss and healing and moving on and rebuilding. And the interesting thing about the business as usual scenario, I think, for global warming is that it does not fit that storyline. It doesn't fit that storyline because it doesn't end on a human timescale. One thing that's, I think, hard to convey here is that this process of warming that we talk about in the business-as-usual scenario goes on and on and on, generation after generation after generation. What we see in looking at that is something unlike a landscape we know. I don't think we have a story like that because it's not something that human beings have endured in the context of being able to pass down a story. It's really unprecedented. Now, the people who suffer from this are the people on the boundaries, the people whose habitat will be shifting or the people who are growing crops that are no longer viable. So there's going to be, but where do you move? If you've got to move, where do you go? Because it doesn't end. So in a way, what I think we're talking about here in terms of a dichotomy is moving to a different storyline, a storyline that does have an ending, where you can move on and put this behind you. And I think in order to do that, you have to somehow get to a point where you stabilize the radiative forcing, as Jim Hansen said. You have to move on to some kind of stabilization scenario. And you need to do that pretty soon or another problem hits you, which Jim talked about, which is the sea level rise. Because unfortunately, the sea level rise, even if we stabilize, will continue to rise. It's the one really slow part of the system because it, as fast as it might go, it's likely to keep going on and on also. So we don't have much time to move off this unending storyline and do it a way that we avoid really dangerous sea level rise. So I also want to say a little bit about, as a scientist, some of the other difficulties in communicating this. I think the difficulty of telling the story of this future, which is unlike our past, is rather hard to do. Maybe we need the help of Hollywood here. There's a lot of sci-fi movies out there. But this, again, it's a story that plays out over generations and lifetimes, so even that might be hard to tell. I think it's also difficult because, you know, as scientists, we have to use our imaginations to think about what might be interesting to work on and what might be important. And as someone who grew up under my father, and I looked up to him as an achiever of an unusual sort, and his principal achievement that's known is this curve of rising, oscillating carbon dioxide at Mauna Loa. And I myself am guilty. I'm guilty of looking at that data as a beautiful piece of science instead of as an alarm bell, which is really what it is. So in a sense, there's a difficulty that we have as scientists in looking at this in its proper human perspective, I think. And I think this is if you go back a few generations, a few decades in this, you see it also in others, other great leaders, like Roger Avell, who is featured so prominently in Gore's movie, and really was an outstanding scientist and a leader in this issue. And yet, in the beginning, he looked at this more as a scientific curiosity than as a real concern. So he was motivated because of its interest as a scientific topic and not as a human topic. I'll be a couple of things to say here.
Please,
just,
go ahead.
Just I'll be brief. I'll try to wrap it up quickly here. In terms of the failure of imagination of scientists, let me point out a couple other issues that struck me as interesting. There are a couple aspects of this global warming story that have been around for a long time, like the issue of trying to work out what the response of climate is to radiative forcing. That problem was identified decades ago, and it's been chipped away at and honed away at. But there are aspects of this that's surprising how many years it took to get them really on the research agenda. And one of them is this big ice sheet problem that Jim Hansen talked about. How did it get to be 2003 or something, and we're just deciding now we have to pay serious attention as a part of the research agenda to this big ice sheet? It's really mind-boggling. So there's a little bit of a sociology question there. Another issue like that is this problem, I don't think you touched on this, but the problem of ocean acidification. It's been clear from the rudiments of the chemistry that if you add CO2 to the atmosphere and it dissolves in the ocean, you're going to change the pH of the ocean. What people couldn't imagine was that would make so much difference to marine organisms. And now scientists have started experimenting with the cultures in slightly acidic seawater. And guess what? They notice, or at least some of them do. So there are big consequences there that went undetected. And my guess is that there are some others out there that we still don't haven't really in our imagination yet. And I'll close here with one that's a little closer to home that I think is something that needs more attention, and it has to do with wildfires and global warming. Now, there's been papers on this recently, and there's concern about the warming itself leading to increased fire frequency, which certainly can happen. But there's another side of the story too, and that is that plants grow faster in higher carbon dioxide. And particularly plants that are slightly water stressed grow faster in general. So you can imagine a situation where in a setting like Santa Barbara or Mediterranean climates where you have a fire and then it's still hot and dry, but the plants grow back faster than they would have before, so you build up fuel again faster. So we could have a situation where both the warming and the CO2 rise together are causing an increased fire frequency. I have a close colleague at San Diego State who, I'm no expert on wildfires, by the way, but who I asked this of. This is a colleague named Walt O'Shell. And he thought, yes, this is a distinct possibility. And he was studying CO2 fertilization of chaparral out behind San Diego, but sadly his plot burned down. So that was the end of that experiment. So I'll wrap it up at this point. So thank you.
Please, Jim.
Could I add a comment on one of your comments?
Yeah.
And that is with regard to the ice sheets. And why has this been essentially overlooked until the last couple of years? I think my comment is it will be sort of self-critical in the nature of scientists now. And I'm actually writing an article now which I call Scientific Reticence. But I think one reason is John Mercer raised the issue a few decades ago, and he got hammered, you know, because the other more conservative glaciologists says John Mercer said there's a danger that West Antarctica could really go unstable and sea level might go up 6 meters, as I say, he really got hammered. And I suppose it became very difficult for him to get funding, you know, and I know Department of Energy became to try to discourage any notions of any real problems. But it just seems to be that if you go out there with assertions like that, that you tend to get hammered. And therefore, now that I'm pointing out, now in this article that I'm writing, Scientific Reticence, I'm using the sea level as part of that, and just showing now the statements that are made are so super cautious, even though I know some glaciologists who are really worried about these ice sheets, but no one's willing to say anything because they don't want to get hammered. And that is very unfortunate, because then we're not doing a job of informing the public in an honest way. So, you know, I was asked to, I'm going to give a discussion at National Press Club in a few weeks. I'm going to try to have a list of things which I think are recommendations. And one of the recommendations is going to be, I think there should be a panel. I think the National Academy of Sciences should be asked to form a panel of the best scientists and really listen to the story on this and then try to write a brief report, not a 7,000-page IPCC thing, but just a like a Charney report, just 20 pages, you know, just a short thing, because I don't think this story has been properly told.
Well, thanks. Those comments from both of you, Ralph, those were great comments. One thing you touched on that I know is a big issue for me and both of my teaching and talking about this issue is, you know, the struggle we have as scientists to talk about that. And you're very kind, the audience, you're clapping and listening to us. But, you know, we're not trained as performers, at least not in this time. And so, you know, when we first devised this series, and Roman and I talked, Roman Baratiuk, we talked a lot about it. You know, I said, well, You know, I don't know how entertaining this is going to be, but you know, this is a problem for us as scientists. The story itself of global warming is a complex one, and it's a hard one to tell in all its facets. And I think you touched on a really good one, good point there. I think both of you touched on this recent report, and I suspect everyone in the audience is aware that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released their working group summary, fourth assessment report on Friday. It got a lot of press. I clipped out a few bits from it. I'll just read you quickly. This is one that particularly struck me. This is from Andrew Revkin, writing The Week in Review. Andy is a New York Times reporter who's probably the best person on this issue. I'll just quote you. This is from yesterday. Before the report's arrival on Friday, the consequences of global warming had been epically imagined. New Orleans-style swampings by superstorms, the specter of an Arctic meltdown, and a water gush that would block heat-toting currents in the Atlantic Ocean and trigger an abrupt European cooldown. As it turned out, the panel's scientific projections deflated some of the more dramatic possibilities. And, you know, in preparing for this lecture and talking to some reporters around town, this is a question that came up again and again. Was the IPCC too conservative? Does it reflect more of a consensus view? I'll read you one other quote, which is from you, Ralph. Ralph, I said it was going to be like Meet the Press, so you have to. So you said on February 2nd to the LA Times, it's good.
Can I go now?
And this also relates to an interesting paper that both Jim and Ralph were co-authors on that just came out on Friday, Science Magazine. The data show that, quote, IPCC is presenting a consensus view that has been okayed by a very large number of interests, so it tends to err on the side of making cautious statements and not exaggerating, said geochemist Ralph Keeling. So I would like to get both of you to comment on what you feel the IPCC, has the IPCC report been in advance? Was it too conservative? Is it useful in that it gives us this consensus view, or is it going to hold us back from finding solutions?
Okay, well, I guess I'll jump in here.
Please.
And I'll be brief enough to let Jim in too. I think the way I look at this is something that may not be easy to pick up on in how it's covered, but I sort of see the process of science as kind of a train with an engine at one end and a caboose at the other end, and the engine is sort of at the cutting edge of speculation and wondering what's real, and the caboose is sort of the end, representing the last skeptics and the last doubters over here, okay? So what the IPCC represents is kind of the caboose in this process. So it is progress because it's moving along with the rest of it, but you don't get the perspective of what's possible from the IPCC very well, I think.
Well, I think IPCC is necessary, and it on some of the issues, it tends to be maybe a little behind in the case of recognizing that the world is really getting warmer and it's due to humans. It's just about there now.
Yeah, exactly. Very likely, they said.
It's very likely. Yeah. But that's useful. I mean, it's useful because you can then say, well, there are thousands of scientists who have looked at this. It's just, unfortunately, in some of these certain cases, like the ice sheet business, where they seem to have fallen down, and it may be, you know, something that is very difficult and on the cutting edge that they're not going to be able to say much. But unfortunately, they should have done a better job of saying that we really don't know this. This is a very nonlinear problem, and maybe there's going to be big response even in 100 years. We don't, but we just can't evaluate it. But instead, they give some numbers and sort of mislead people into thinking that there's no problem, there's very little problem. So I think it's more a flaw in this particular report, but the process is probably necessary.
Yeah, and certainly the number they've come out with on sea level, I think, which was an upper limit of about 0.6 meter, was that right, for the end of the century, seems a lot more conservative than some might think. And I think, Jim, in your talk, you alluded to that possibility.
Yeah, even if you just assume that it was a linear problem and the sea level rise will be similar to what it was last century, but in proportion to the temperature change, you would get a bigger number than that. But it's not a linear problem. It's a very nonlinear one, and it's a very hard problem.
Yeah, and I mean, along that line, I'll just read you a couple other quotes. They're not from you, though, so don't worry. This is one that Ralph Cicerone just was in the Times yesterday. And it relates to this question of how we talk about the problem. Do we need to be more dramatic or do we need to be more conservative? Ralph Cicerone, who's president of the National Academy and a noted atmospheric chemist, said, quote, "Does it take a crisis to get people to go along a new path? Or can they respond to a series of rational incremental gains in knowledge?" That's the question. So again, I mean, it seems to me that there's this crucial way that we parse what we're discovering about the Earth.
Please, right. Either. Well, I guess, I mean, the example of the ozone problem and the banning of CFCs shows you can get action without too much in the way of dramatic consequences having showed. But I think the global warming is so much harder that it doesn't surprise me in a way that people in this country, or really in many countries, would be hesitant about something that involves major investments or changes in lifestyle for something that is just a theory. So, and I'm not saying global warming is a theory, but I think 20 years ago you could maybe make that case more credibly than you could now. I think it's beyond that point. So I think the reason we're here with this kind of crowd is because people feel it in their bones, and there's some element of fear that's crept into this. And so sadly, I think we're already there.
Well, yeah, you know, I would say there are two reasons why I think we could have reacted to the knowledge that we had sooner. And that was the attempt with a deck 10 years ago with Kyoto Protocol. Now, I think there are two reasons that have prevented this, that are particularly relevant. In the United States, and I think that our founding fathers would be very disappointed to see what has happened with the way our government is functioning. One of those things is two things is the role of special interests. Our elections are not there is far too strong a role of special interests. You need money to win elections, and both in presidential elections and in congressional elections, there's too big a role for special interests. And they have had a huge role in the failure of the U.S. to be ready to address this problem. And the other thing is, again, which I think our founding fathers would be very disappointed, is the fact they assumed that we have an educated, informed public. And that has become much more difficult because sources of public information have been taken over for political purposes. The science agencies now have political appointees in the Office of Public Affairs. And the information that gets to the public is tainted by politics. And if those two things were not there, I think we should have negotiated the Kyoto Protocol because it wasn't very fair to the U.S., but if it hadn't been for those factors, I think we could have got going on this problem a decade ago.
I guess that I want to ask a few more questions. I know someone out there has audience questions for me, and I'll need those in a minute. If you've got them, great. So just a couple more things, and then we'll take some of the audience questions. I want to ask you, Jim, specifically, and I'm just trying to think of things the audience would like to ask Jim. Do you feel, if you kind of add together Ralph and my experience, we're probably roughly equal at Jim, I think, in terms of numbers of years now.
Oh, a number of years.
Number of years, at least. I'm not, not in terms of knowledge generation. But do you feel optimistic? I mean, you've seen a lot of change, from this problem when you started on it, after coming from Iowa to Nassagis. And do you feel optimistic? Do you think that it's something we can do? I mean, you've called specifically for us to take action within the next decade, for example.
Yeah, actually, we need to be on a different path within a decade, which means begin to get some actions within the next couple of years. And I think that there's certainly been a lot more indication in the last couple of years where more recognition that we need to do that. So I think that that I'm optimistic that we can help we can avoid business as usual. But there's still going to be effects. I was surprised, actually, that already by the middle 1990s we had come as far as we appeared to be, and then we just didn't complete that. And frankly, it's only I didn't realize how serious the problem was until the late 1990s. It didn't. I blame myself for not having more insight into the positive feedbacks. And that the climate system is really more sensitive than we thought. When we were thinking about the Charney problem 20 years ago, we thought in terms of, the water vapor feedback and the clouds and the sea ice and the sensitivity that gives to the system. But then there are these slower feedbacks that we really weren't including. The vegetation changes with time, and we can already see this in northern Canada and Siberia, where we're getting more trees, and that's a positive feedback. And the ice sheets, we were thinking of them as more stable. Right. As they shrink, that's a positive feedback. The carbon cycle has positive feedbacks. So the problem is more serious than we realized 10 years ago, and I think we should have realized some of these things a little earlier. But
certainly you were a very outspoken voice for this early on. I mean, it took IPCC till this year to say, very likely, and I think you said something like that maybe 20 years ago.
I think Jim Hansen's the last person who should feel guilty about not standing up on this issue.
I'm just going to get these questions, but just while I'm getting that, Ralph, how about you? Do you feel optimistic?
I feel hopeful in the following respect. This is speaking as an American citizen. I still harbor some pride in being an American. And part of that pride comes from the feeling that this country actually still has a lot of can-do and a spirit of enterprise and a spirit of doing good that we can harness and really get out in front of this problem. And in a sense, we're not that far behind, because the rest of the world is really just starting to move on this too. So if there's anything I can convey here tonight, it's that go forth with a sense of can do and conquer. And that's, if we're going to solve this problem, it's going to be through that kind of mechanism.
Exactly. Amen.